The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I do think this case highlights how the whole notion of this military commission is and the way it's functioning and having all these issues never decided and keep reoccurring and popping up again and dragging out for years and years just is an antipathy of what a military commission is supposed to be. Instead, you have this hybrid, military commission process here, which is not the quick and dirty, process, but instead is now has all these procedural rights, all the layers of review before the military review commission, before the DC circuit. No one's deciding anything more than they have to. Things get dragged out for decades. This is just a crazy application of what the traditional concept of a military commission, has been over the years. I think this is a failed enterprise in many ways.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 29th, 2016. On Thursday, October 20th, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled once again in the case of Ali Hamza al-Bulul, a Guantanamo detainee convicted by military commission for inchoate conspiracy to commit war crimes. In a divided and inconclusive en banc decision, the D.C. Circuit affirmed Bulul's conviction, overturning the court's panel decision vacating the conviction last June. The Lawfare podcast has covered the twists and turns of Bulul's case in the past, and now we're back once more with Steve Laddick of the University of Texas at Austin and Bob Loeb, a partner at Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe and the former acting deputy director of the Civil Division Appellate Staff at the Department of Justice. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 194, Bulul, 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 Bulul.
Okay, so we have an opinion here with no majority and I believe five different rationales for multiple different supposed holdings. So Bob, can you start by just giving us a lay of the land of the Bulul opinion? Everybody thinks it's important, and we got to start with what it sort of does and sort of doesn't do, right?
Sure. The key issue was whether the conspiracy charge against Bulul could be brought before a military commission or had to be brought before an Article III federal court. And after a long wait for this in bank decision, there's a failure to get a majority position of the judges of the D.C. Circuit. We have four judges led by Judge Kavanaugh holding that it is appropriate to bring such a conspiracy claim before a military commission, rejecting challenges under Article 1 and Article 3. You have two judges joining that result that the case can go forward before the military commission, but on different grounds. One, that there's plain error review because these challenges to the military commission's authority were not brought in a timely fashion. And also we have Judge Millett and Judge Wilkins looks at the charges which were brought and the findings and says, well, this is actually a much more traditional law of war claim and not just a sort of a naked conspiracy claim. And therefore, I don't think we need even to reach these broader issues reached by the four judges. We have in dissent Judge Rogers, Judge Tatel, and Judge Pillard, who go through all of the arguments marshaled on the other side, but their basic holding is that crimes need to be charged and tried before in an Article III federal court, except if they fall into a limited exception. And that exception, as far as when it goes to military commissions, requires that the offense be established and understood under international law of war, and that conspiracies don't meet that criteria. There's much more detail and distinction between the different positions, but that sort of rounds it up.
So we'll get into the detail momentarily. But Steve, who won this case? I mean, I can, on the one hand, the government, you know, preserves Bahlul's conviction, which was very much in doubt. But on the other hand, it's precedential for basically nothing, as far as I can tell, except that you don't apply plain error review. Who won?
Lawyers, I guess, won this case. You know, I think the best way to look at this from my perspective is that the military commission prosecutors, led obviously by General Martins, I think can definitely claim this as a victory, if for no other reason than they have an en banc majority affirming really what has been one of the more important convictions of the military commissions to date. But, you know, I'm reluctant to say that the government writ large won because of the uncertainty that Bob described, and because of the extent to which, as long as there is still this lurking, lingering question about whether the military commissions really can constitutionally try non-law of war offenses, I still think there's going to be this cloud of illegitimacy hovering over the commissions. And so I think from the perspective of sort of broader future-looking executive branch policy, this certainly isn't a loss, but it's also not a win. So, you know, it's a jobs program for lawyers, especially military commission lawyers. I'm not sure it's much more than that.
Okay, so Steve, this is not the first time that Bahlul has been before the D.C. Circuit.
I think you can say that again.
You and I did a podcast once which we called Bahlul, Bahlul, Bahlul. This is like, you know, Bahlul, 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 Bahlul. So give us a little bit of history of this litigation. You would think for an essentially uncontested criminal case, which this was, you wouldn't have, you know, 10 years of litigation following it. But walk us through the history of this a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I think this is actually exactly the point, Ben, that, you know, the fact that it's taken this long and we haven't gotten a resolution, or at least a definitive resolution, is perhaps the biggest headline from the D.C. Circuit's ruling. So, you know, the most important thing to understand about the history of the Bahlul litigation is that he was actually convicted in September of 2008, right? So George Bush was still president when his criminal appeal began. And so what we really have to understand is why it took so long. So first, the case took a couple of years to go through the Intermediate Military Appellate Court, the Court of Military Commission Review. Then Bahlul actually was really lurking behind the Hamdan case, which was the first major military commission appeal to reach the D.C. Circuit under the Military Commissions Act of 2006. A three-judge panel decides the Hamdan case in October of 2012, and basically that leads to a three-judge panel just concluding in January 2013 in Bahlul's case that they had to follow Hamdan, that basically the MCA could not be read to authorize prosecution for things that might not be war crimes that took place before the MCA was enacted. That's what provokes the first round of en banc litigation in Al Bahlul, culminating in the July 2014 en banc decision that basically splits on the three crimes Bahlul was convicted of. So a majority of the en banc court in, I guess, Al Bahlul 2, if we're going to number them, holds that even under plain error review, that is to say, even if Bahlul didn't raise this argument at trial, the commissions could not try the crimes of material support or solicitation because that would violate the ex post facto clause, because it wasn't clear at the time of his conduct that those were offenses subject to trial by military commission. But the court says, at least on plain error review, we're not as sure about conspiracy. Conspiracy is close enough. We're going to leave conspiracy alone from an ex post facto perspective. And at that point, the en banc court sends the case back to the original three-judge panel, which is judges Tatel, Rogers, and Henderson. That three-judge panel, with the ex post facto issue out of the way, then has to confront Albalul's forward-looking challenges to the power of a military commission to try the remaining intact charge, conspiracy. That culminates in the June 2015 three-judge panel decision, what we might call Albalul 3, where a divided panel holds that it violates Article 3 of the Constitution to try things that are not clearly established international war crimes before a military commission. Inchoate conspiracy, according to the panel, is not such a clearly established international war crime, and so the commission could not try it. Judge Henderson dissented. This leads to the second round of en banc maneuvering in Albalul, I guess what we'll now call Albalul 4, the October 20th decision from this year. And in Albalul 4, as Bob summarized, you don't have a majority of the court for any one rationale, but basically the court affirms Balul's conspiracy conviction for divided grounds. So, you know, here we are basically 8 full years after Albalul was initially convicted. We're finally through the D.C. Circuit, but we don't actually have a definitive answer on his principal challenge to his conspiracy conviction, that it violates Article 3, or his residual challenge, that even if it doesn't, it violates equal protection. And that's, I think, what's most frustrating to me about last week's decision.
So, Bob, there is one sitting judge on the D.C. Circuit who conspicuously did not participate in this case, which is Merrick Garland, but could theoretically, if he is confirmed to be onto the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court were to grant cert in this, once again be a sort of deciding vote at the higher level. Is this done at the D.C. Circuit now, and what do you see as the prospects for the Supreme Court taking a look at this?
Well, I think it's done in the D.C. Circuit. Judge Garland didn't participate in the case. Before getting to your answer, I think it's remarkable that Judge Millett and Wilkins sort of let this result land where it does, based on their own particular predilections. It's part of the job of the court and the judges to come up with a rule of law which is going to be applicable to later cases. And although each of their decisions have some substance to them, you know, just like in our politics, where, you know, things only function if you actually compromise and discuss and are, you know, willing to reach agreement, even if you don't agree with 100% of what's in Judge Kavanaugh's decision or getting him to modify his decision so you can join it. Instead, they, you know, join neither side and even each other, seeming to, you know, I think both of them may have interests in being appointed to the Supreme Court in the future, and this may protect their positions, not having, you know, ruled for the defendant here and not, you know, gone with the majority. It seems very indulgent of them to have done this. But as to, you know, where things go, the Supreme Court, once the election is over, and, you know, I would expect Judge Garland to move quickly thereafter, assuming the result of the election, that this is the kind of case where the Supreme Court should take this to resolve this issue about the role of military tribunals in these kind of cases, the Article 3 limitations, the Article 1 limitations, and also the define and punish clause and what Congress's authorities. All these things are wrapped into this case and need guidance from the Supreme Court. And I would think a fully staffed Supreme Court would take this case, and that there's, I think, even more than I would slight Judge Millett and Wilkins for not having grappled with the merits here and reached either the majority or dissent position. I think it would also be a failure of the Supreme Court not to take this case and to resolve it, especially knowing the 9/11 cases are in the offing, and the guidance is really needed. And I think both the dissent and the plurality here agree on that, that there was a imperative to not just sort of rest on ways of trying to avoid the problem here, an imperative to actually address these issues and to resolve them on the merits.
Let's take these issues, the substantive issues of the case inside out, and let's deal with Wilkins and Millett first before we get to the fundamental issue that divides the plurality from the dissenters. Millett's basic argument is that this should be resolved on the basis of plain error review, and that it's a pretty easy call on the basis of plain error review in the government's favor. She has no other votes for that proposition, and the dissent is actually quite dismissive of this idea. I think Kavanaugh deals with it in a footnote, but the joint dissent really spends some time kind of yelling at her about it. Is there anything, this is for both of you, is there anything to be said for her position here? It is the basis on which they resolved Bahlul 1 or Bahlul 2, the first Bahlul en banc. I mean, is this a situation where Millett is just kind of out to lunch, or does she have an argument that the rest of the court is not being sensitive to?
I mean, I'm happy to take that first. I mean, I think, Ben, I guess the best I can say about Judge Millett's opinion is that on the Article 3 question, which, you know, I really think is the central question in this case, you know, I think the Supreme Court muddied the waters a bit a year ago in a case that has nothing to do with military commissions, in a bankruptcy case called Wellness Network International versus Sharif, where the court, I think, rather strangely held that a party can consent its way into a non-Article III adjudication that it otherwise could not be privy to. That, right, that is to say that consent could create constitutional jurisdiction in a non-Article III court where it otherwise would not exist. That conclusion, I think, is problematic in its own right, but I think it provides at least the cover of credulity to Judge Millett saying that's also true in a military commission, that a failure to object to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court, should be taken as consenting to the jurisdiction, at least in some regard. The two problems I see with that, first, is that I think there's a world of difference between a civil bankruptcy proceeding and a criminal prosecution in a military commission. And so even if one were to read the Supreme Court's Sharif decision for all it's worth, I think there still is a missing analytical step about why the same principles ought to apply in the context of a much more coercive and government-run proceeding contra bankruptcy. But second, and I actually think this goes to Bob's point about whether things are over in the D.C. Circuit, in holding that Bahlul had forfeited all of his arguments, Judge Millett actually completely perverts the record. It's pretty darn clear that Bahlul actually raised the equal protection objection, the one that at least Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Henderson and Judge Brown think is frivolous, and that he actually objected pretty specifically for a pro se criminal defendant in a military commission to whether the commissions were constitutional because they only applied to non-citizens. Judge Millett completely ignores that in her discussion of why, even though she doesn't think the equal protection objection is frivolous, she thinks it's not meritorious. And indeed, this has now formed the basis for a petition for partial rehearing that Al-Bahlul's counsel filed on his behalf on October 24th. So, you know, I think that there's, if I can be a little coy, I don't think Judge Millett's opinion is itself frivolous, but I do think it's unfortunate in two respects. One, that I don't think she takes nearly seriously enough the very different stakes of consent in the context of a military commission. And two, I think she sort of runs roughshod over the other arguments that I think Al-Bahlul did preserve, including the equal protection claim. And just to sort of go back to Bob's big point, and all in the process, depriving the D.C. Circuit of an opportunity to meaningfully resolve this issue. And frankly, Ben, I think actually increasing the imperative that the Supreme Court step in.
So what do you think, Bob? Is there anything to be said for Millett's position?
So plain error is, you know, well-known doctrine in criminal cases, which, you know, in civil cases, if you don't raise an issue, an objection, you don't even have an opportunity of plain error to raise it on appeal. In criminal cases, you're generally, for domestic cases, required to, you know, raise your objections. And if you don't, you can raise arguments that your counsel was incompetent. But you can also, recognizing that that's going to come later on, and if it was actually a plain error, and that we'll get a ruling the counsel was incompetent, and then we're going to have a new trial anyhow, the courts have a doctrine of plain error, which allows them to sort of cut to the chase and say, look, if it's a structural, clear error, we allow you to raise it now, as opposed to having to do it maybe through the back door of an incompetent counsel claim. Here, you know, if it's a prudential doctrine, you know, intended to encourage people to raise the claims. And, you know, here, as Steve said, this also goes to Article 3 issues as to the entire authority to vest this in the military commission. That would be also the authority of the, you know, the D.C. Circuit and the courts to be reviewing this perhaps illegitimate exercise of authority. You know, if you could hardly get more structural than these type of Article 1 and Article 3 claims. And the prudential reasons you might want to give for encouraging people to raise objections, I think are trumped for the obvious reason that there's an imperative to get a clear answer here, and that the issues were fully vetted and raised. And the government itself, you can always waive a waiver. They themselves, until very late in the game, basically said it was fine to adjudicate these issues and sort of grasped onto this at the very end. So I really don't think there is much there. This is not your traditional criminal case. This goes to the fundamental question of what authority the military commission can exercise.
All right. So that dispenses with Judge Millett. Let's turn to Judge Wilkins. Wilkins has an entirely different, though somewhat overlapping, theory of the case, which is that actually there's not nearly as much distance between the actual prosecution of Bahlul and the international war crime of JCE conspiracy, or sort of Pinkerton liability conspiracy, than the dissenters think. And so you don't really need to resolve, in his view, the question, the big question that separates the plurality from the dissent. You merely need to look at the facts that he was convicted of and say, well, that kind of satisfies the international law standard. The dissent says, come on, you have a right as a defendant to know what you've been charged with. He wasn't charged with, you know, conspiracy as a theory of liability. He's charged with conspiracy as a standalone crime. He's not charged with there being a completed offense. So I guess the question here is, does Wilkins have a point that this is really harmless error? Which is a term he doesn't use, but strikes me as what he's really saying. Or is this an effort on his part to kind of, you know, rewrite the rules after the government has pled it and charged it one way litigated it one way for, as Steve points out, 8 or 9 years? Steve, what do you think? Is there anything to be said for Wilkins's view of this?
So, you know, it's funny. I at the risk of referring listeners to an old Lawfare post, there's a July 2013 post I wrote on this exact question that, you know, I think has only gotten better with age. I think the answer is no.
That's true of all Lawfare posts, by the way. They get better with age.
Like fine wine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that everything I've written falls into that category, Ben, but I appreciate that. I think the short answer is no. And the reason why the answer is no is because what Wilkins is basically doing is trying to correct a harmless error that he thinks was made by the prosecutor, not by the court. And so, right, what he's basically saying is the prosecution in this case should have charged Bahlul differently and should have structured the indictment differently and should have alleged different facts that it looks like were established at trial. The problem with that is that the harmless error doctrine is about trial court errors, not prosecutorial errors. And so I'm not exactly sure how you could retroactively, you know, fix an error in how the prosecution tried a case based on an after-the-fact appellate construction of the record. But don't take my word for it. There's actually a whole bunch of, you know, Supreme Court case law here that actually seems to suggest that it cannot be harmless error for a conviction to be affirmed based upon a charged offense and theory of liability that was not submitted to or found by the jury, in this case, the members of the military commission. So, you know, I think that it's really a stretch. And not just a stretch, but also it's basically allowing the prosecution to have its cake and eat it too, for Judge Wilkins to say, oh, look, I can find in the record enough where there could have been a much more convincing case. You know, Ben, I've always thought that the hardest question about Article 3 would be if the government had actually charged Bahlul the way Judge Wilkins contemplates. That is to say, if they had charged him for a completed war crime, where the theory of liability, as opposed to the crime itself, was what international law refers to as joint criminal enterprise. If that had happened, I think this would be a much closer call. I think Judge Wilkins would be on to something. But, you know, I think it's, if I can be a little blunt, inexcusable for an appellate judge to basically retroactively transmogrify a conviction where the only error was the prosecution's charging decision.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, you have to agree with that, that it's, this is just way too cute. You know, he's basically putting himself back in the role of chief prosecutor and how he would have proceeded with the case. But you can understand, you know, he's looking at it from a higher level, 30,000 feet up. We're being asked to decide what kind of claims that can Congress allow to be heard or not. He sees that some conspiracy claims actually are consistent with law, you know, international laws of war, and some are not, and that, you know, not every conspiracy claim is the same, and he doesn't feel like he has to here issue a decision regarding how all inchoate conspiracies may or not fall in, but let's deal with the one we have here. Let's look at the charges, look at the facts, and they actually align much more closely with what is understood to be within the international laws of war. And he says, well, he's, you know, instead of trying to replete and say harmless error, he's not saying that as much as that. Look, I'm just looking at what I have here, what the conviction was, what the finding was, and I think that lines up with the laws of war. And I can understand that basic. He doesn't want to, you know, there's a case before them. He doesn't want to, you know, reach out farther than he has to decide this case. That's often an conservative instinct in these kind of cases.
Okay, so we are largely in agreement with that caveat. The two of you are largely in agreement, though Bob is more understanding of Wilkins's position than Steve is, that it's pretty hard here to avoid the fundamental question that separates Judge Kavanaugh and company from the joint dissent, which brings us to that question. Judge Kavanaugh's position in a nutshell is, of course, Congress can allow the charging in a military commission of a non-international law of war offense. The two most prominent military commissions in our history, the Lincoln conspiracy case and the Quirin Nazi saboteurs case, both involved exactly this charge. And by the way, the concept of what has been chargeable historically in military commissions has always included certain non-law of war, international law of war offenses like sabotage and espionage and the like. The dissent turns around and says, nonsense, there's never been neither of those facts is what it seems. And in fact, the Supreme Court has always been very consistent that the law of military commissions jurisdictionally is limited to the international as opposed to other law of war offenses. So I guess the question is, as a preliminary matter, who's right? Steve, I mean, you a lot of your work is sort of echoed in the dissent, but I'm interested. So let me ask Bob about this first, and then, but who's got the better of the argument here?
Who has the better of the argument? I think the majority position, the plurality position, ultimately is correct that there is not, and really should not be, this firm line that the power of Congress is limited by what the international community or what, you know, legal academia, you know, think are sufficiently established international law norms, and that there has to be some role that Congress plays. Congress gets a role in the Constitution itself to define and punish offenses of the law of nations. It has been granted all the war making powers that include, by inference, the power to have a military commission try war crimes. So, you know, Kavanaugh makes, I think, a very strong case that the Constitution doesn't limit the congressional power here by what is accepted by international tribunals or by academics in writing the restatement of law about foreign offenses, and that to turn over that core power to international tribunals or international bodies, he argues, actually it would be completely inappropriate in our constitutional structures. I think that's the framework he's working from, and then he's trying to, of course, then find evidence to support that position, looking at the Lincoln Mudd case, and looking at the Quirin cases, that those involved conspiracy cases, that we had cases involving spying. The government labels these sort of older cases under a U.S. common law of what can be charged before a military commission, so that they put in different marks. Military commission can hear things clearly if they're established under international law, but also within this broader traditional role that within the United States have been found to be appropriate before a military commission, and especially then if Congress then recognizes it and codifies it under its Article I powers, that's appropriate. Judge Kavanaugh suggests there's limits on that, and that's one of the main criticisms of the dissent at the end. It's like, well, Judge Kavanaugh doesn't actually define what those limits are, and you can imagine if we get a president who has more despotic type leanings, that you could have military commissions set up and Congress establishing all sorts of things that we take for granted today as war crimes. And that's sort of the big fear, that you're opening Pandora's box here. The government tries to put those by focusing on that historical nature of the offenses, and saying that they need to be a non-citizen, and try to put limits on itself. But interesting, Judge Kavanaugh doesn't actually adopt or embrace those, and says, "I'm not going to tell you what the limits are of Congress on this because we don't know. Also, I'm not going to look only historically. We could have cyber crimes; they might be listed as war crimes in the future. We can't handcuff Congress in that way." And so, I think the dissent has a strong case. There's a lot of evidence in the old cases where Supreme Court is looking to international law, but you also can't overlook the history that there's been these other type of offenses out there which have never been considered, law of war offenses under international law itself.
So, Steve, who's got the better of this? I know what you're going to say.
Well, I mean, do you want to tell me what I'm about to say, and we'll see if you're right?
No, I happen to have Steve Vladeck right here. Let's let him speak for himself. As Woody Allen might say.
I think the only question presented in this case were the Article I question about whether Congress, acting under the Define and Punish Clause, can make the crime of inchoate conspiracy part of the U.S. law. I actually would agree with Bob and with Judge Kavanaugh. I do think that, and when it comes to Article I, Congress is entitled to at least some latitude in recognizing emerging crimes and emerging norms and emerging principles as offenses against the law of nations. You know, otherwise the law of nations would be static. No country would be able to go first. So, you know, like Judge Kavanaugh, I think Bob makes a very compelling case that where the question is about Congress's Article I power, giving Congress at least some wiggle room, you know, some deference to decide for itself the scope of international law is something I can stomach. Again, I think there's a question about where that line ends. You know, could Congress really say that the failure to maintain minimum essential health insurance is a violation of the law of nations, and then the healthcare case becomes a lot easier? I'm skeptical. But at least, you know, at a high level of abstraction, there's some merit there. The problem that I have with all of this is it completely neglects the very different work and the very different role of what we might call the Article III question of whether, separate from Congress's power to create and recognize the offense, it's also permissible to try this particular offense in a non-Article III military commission. And this is where I think Judge Kavanaugh, you know, loses, I think, some of the persuasive force of his opinion. With regard to the Lincoln assassination, you know, Marty Lederman has a brand new paper up on SSRN called The Law ? Of the Lincoln Assassination, which I think makes a pretty darn compelling case that no one had ever thought the Lincoln assassination was a strong precedent for the power of a military commission until Judge Kavanaugh. Right, Marty actually has one quote in there about how the Lincoln precedent is one that no self-respecting military lawyer would look straight in the eye. You know, so the historical precedents here are not nearly as clear on the Article III question as Judge Kavanaugh wants them to be. And I think it's pretty darn important that in Ex parte Curin, the most important of the Supreme Court cases in this field, part of why Chief Justice Stone concluded that the military commissions trying the Nazi saboteurs were constitutional was because he identified an exception to the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial for offenses committed by enemy belligerents against the laws of war. The real question that the Al-Balul court, and indeed that Judge Kavanaugh's concurrence does not answer, is what is the basis for a separate exception to the jury trial right, and as such to Article III adjudication for offenses that are not recognized as violations of the laws of war. And I think that's the problem in this case that the concurring opinion by Judge Kavanaugh largely skirts. I think that's the real question for the Supreme Court, and I think that's, you know, that really has been the central question about the military commissions since their inception. In many ways, I think, actually, Judge Henderson's dissent in what we might call Al-Balul III, the June 2015 panel decision, really confronted the Article III question much more directly, although, you know, as I've explained at some length at Lawfare, not, in my view, altogether convincingly.
I just want to point out that this is maybe the first time an opinion by Judge Henderson has been compared favorably to an opinion on the same point by Judge Kavanaugh. So,
Ben, I mean, just to be clear, right? I mean, I think the problem with Judge Kavanaugh's concurrence is not that its analysis is flawed, but that it's an exercise in misdirection by devoting so much attention to the Article I question and so little discussion of the Article III question. The only argument Judge Kavanaugh has for the Article III point is the precedent for trying two offenses, spying and aiding the enemy, in military courts that have not been historically recognized as international war crimes. And in Curin, the way that the court dealt with spying was by misidentifying it as an international war crime. So, you know, it's not that I think Judge Henderson's dissent in the panel opinion is an exercise in fantastic, beautiful legal writing. It's that I do think it is a more representative treatment of what the real point in dispute is than Judge Kavanaugh's concurrences either in the first en banc decision from 2014 or in the October 20 ruling from this year.
So I want to finish up with a by briefly touching on the question of what this means for the future of military commissions. More recent military commissions cases have assiduously avoided charging standalone conspiracy, inchoate conspiracy. And so at one level, this is a sort of orphan case, right, that goes to the sort of theoretical ability of the military commissions to hear charges that actually aren't being brought anymore. And so, Bob, if you could start us, I mean, why – and yet everybody sort of has a sense that this – the uncertainty of this case, as you've said, sort of does cast a kind of ongoing pall over the military commissions, including the 9/11 case. And so I'm interested in the question of why this case and the uncertainty that remains in it matters in a forward-looking sense. Or is it largely matter for theoretical reasons because Mark Martins is way too smart to make this mistake again?
Well, it leaves open, you know, as to the current ongoing commissions, the type of challenges that Ballou will raise, even if the prosecution's trying to be more sophisticated about charging offenses that are more established under international law. So whether or not this is the undoing of the 9/11, you know, case at the end, you know, maybe not, because they're charged on, more established offenses. But it having this lack of clarity about the authority of the military commissions and about what Congress can assign to military commissions is, I think, not just limited to this one case, but also leaves open the door for future challenges. I do think this case highlights, as we talked again about, just how the whole notion of this military commission is and the way it's functioning and having all these issues never decided and keep reoccurring and popping up again and dragging out for years and years just is an antipathy of what a military commission is supposed to be. As the dissent outlines, you have the military courts in a couple different situations. You have when we occupy territory, they become like the territorial courts. But they're also in this role of in the battlefield. If you need to have a military commission to determine law of war offenses, or to have law of war offenses decided on a more expeditious basis without all the accoutrements of all the reviews and rights that you might get under Article 3, instead you have this hybrid military commission process here, which is not the quick and dirty process, but instead is now has all these procedural rights, all the layers of review before the military review commission, before the DC circuit. No one's deciding anything more than they have to. Things get dragged out for decades. This is just a crazy application of what the traditional concept of a military commission, has been over the years. And, and this high level of process, high level of ambiguity out there is just going to dissuade, in the future, capturing people and subjecting them to military commissions like this. I think this is a failed enterprise in many ways. And I think it's notable that when we had a chance to capture bin Laden and subject him to military commission, we did not. Instead, what a expeditious military commission would have done was charge him for being a war criminal and had him executed on that basis, and that would have happened. But if we had charged him under the Military Commissions Act, under this snail-like process, bin Laden would be sitting in Guantanamo today, or wherever Obama would have brought him, who knows, and going on for decades. And that was an untenable, result. And hence, I think there was even more a thumb on the scale of just, taking him out rather than capturing him and charging him with war crimes.
So, Steve, what do you think, other than that it's fodder for endless law review articles.
No, man, I'm done.
And Lawfare debates. Why does this case matter at this point?
So I think it matters for four different reasons. And let me see if I can briefly sketch those out. So the first is actually one of the three pending cases in the military commissions, the case of Hadi al-Iraqi, does actually include a standalone conspiracy charge And so we actually do have at least one case where there will be a direct impact on the government's ability to proceed based on the resolution here. Indeed, I suspect that if and when al-Balul seeks certiorari from the Supreme Court, the government will point to al-Iraqi as a different and better opportunity for the Supreme Court to wait for the conspiracy question. The second, I think, reason involves the prospect of future cases, not obviously under the last couple months of the Obama administration, but it's not hard to imagine a future president dusting off the Military Commissions Act in a future scenario. And I think that raises a big question about, what is the clear precedent for these trials? What are the rules? What kinds of things can the government do and what can it not do? In that regard, I mean, I think it's worth considering the en banc decision in al-Balul alongside the three-judge panel's decision on August 30th in the al-Nashiri case. This is the guy who's being charged for his role in bombing the USS Cole and a French tanker. The D.C. Circuit on August 30th abstained from resolving pretty significant jurisdictional challenges in Nashiri's case until after he's actually convicted, which may not be until 2024 or 2025. So, we're going to have this lingering jurisdictional cloud over the commissions in two of the highest profile cases, al-Balul and Nashiri, until and unless these questions are resolved. Third, by some estimates, the government has spent over $1 billion on the military commissions over the last, 13, 14 years. They've secured exactly 8 convictions, 4 of which have been vacated. And so, why is this case important? Figuring out whether that money was well spent, I think, is a pretty important endeavor. Figuring out whether, despite all of the points Bob makes about the inefficiencies of the commissions, this was a worthwhile experiment in creating a precedent going forward, I think is pretty important no matter what happens to al-Balul. But fourth, and I think perhaps most importantly, I think this case is important because it reaffirms something Bob said right at the end there, which is that the government could have avoided almost all of this if it had hewed far more closely to the clearly established precedents. Bob and I can fight about what history does and does not support. I think there's no question that if the government had just stuck to using the Guantanamo military commissions to try clearly established international war crimes, this litigation would never have gone anywhere. We would not have had the Hamdan case. We would not have had Congress's response in the Military Commissions Act. And so, at the end of the day, Ben, the reason why this case is most important to me is because it is, no matter how it comes out, an indictment of all of the costs, financial and otherwise, that the government incurred for trying to push the envelope past what precedent clearly supported, and at least in my view, past what the Constitution allows. 9 days before the en banc decision in October, Judge Kavanaugh wrote in the case invalidating the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Board that it can be irresponsible for a court to unduly delay ruling on a fundamental and ultimately unavoidable structural challenge given the systemic ramifications of such an issue. Here we are, 14 years into the military commissions, 10 years into the Military Commissions Act, 8 years into al-Balul's case. This case is important at the end of the day for no other reason than because we need a ruling. whether this is legal or not is a pretty important question that transcends just this one guy at Guantanamo. And I think, Judge Kavanaugh was right then. I think he was right in his concurrence in al-Balul in the en banc case, where he said this case needs to be decided now. 7 of the 9 judges that decided the en banc case would have decided on the merits now. And I think now the question is, will the Supreme Court, follow suit?
Well, if and when they grant cert, I hope we will reconvene and for Balul 5.
Without Judge Garland. I think it's worth stressing that because he actually sat on the en banc court and was part of the decision in what we might call al-Balul 2, the July 2014 decision, I'm pretty sure he'd have to recuse. So, no matter what happens with his confirmation, I think we're looking at an 8-justice court.
I think Justice Roberts was on some earlier Guantanamo.
Hamdan. Yeah, John, when he was on the D.C. Circuit, Judge Roberts was the third judge on the original panel in Hamdan in 2005, which is why when it got to the Supreme Court in 2006, Hamdan was decided by an 8-justice court. So, you know, there's a little bit of history repeating here, which I guess is, you know, perfectly fitting for a case that seems to be stuck in an infinite time loop.
It's true, although, I mean, Judge Roberts was the third judge in the decision, whereas Judge Garland ultimately did not take part in the decision, and I think therefore would have a better argument against recusal than Roberts would have had.
But he did take part in the decision in Abelul too, right? I mean, he's one of the judges in the, you know, majority opinion in Abelul too, throwing out the material support and solicitation charges under plain error review. So, you know, I think it's actually a pretty unavoidable recusal case.
That's interesting, because I would have thought if those questions are not among the questions that the Supreme Court grants cert in, it's at least somewhat differently postured from the Roberts situation.
And the justices get a lot of discretion on whether they're going to recuse themselves or not. So it would, you know, interesting to see. Also, we don't know what Justice Kagan's involvement was with any of these issues, too, is whether she'd be recused. So there could be more recusals out there.
Well, first we have to have a cert petition. And in the meantime, thank you both for joining us. And I have a feeling that we'll be back.
Thanks, Ben.
All right, thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who's always happy to share her opinions on Ex Parte Quirin. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.